Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of July 16th, 2010. The path to economic recovery could be paved with numbers, specifically credit scores. Folks with good credit scores can buy houses, get loans for new cars, get approved for credit cards, and all of that fuels consumer and small business spending. The bad news for all of us, then, is that the number of Americans with dismal FICO scores is going up. Used to be that about 15% of us had a score of less than 600, but today, according to the Associated Press, it's more like 25%. Jeff Horwich has our story.
The recession has lowered millions more Americans into the realm of credit untouchables. Take 27-year-old Steve Miles, an engineering student and Iraq war vet in Oregon, who's become unfortunately intimate with his FICO score.
Last time I checked, it was about 493.
Steve says he returned from Iraq to find his wife, now ex-wife, had racked up huge credit card bills. Then in February, he lost his job with the city government. More bills went unpaid, dragging his credit score below 500. Forget trying to finance a house or a car with a score like that.
No one will even look at me or consider me.
Steve is about to declare bankruptcy, which will drive his credit score even deeper for years. A bad score can take 7 years to fix, even once you've addressed every blemish. That's a long time for 43 million people to be shut out of large parts of the economy. But that's how many American consumers now have FICO scores below 600.
Right now, 620 is the magic number.
Phoenix mortgage banker Justin McHood says with a score of 620, you can at least get in the door for a mortgage backed by the Federal Housing Administration. For a conventional loan or refinancing, the number is closer to 700.
People call in and they say, I need to do something to lower my payments, and we're just unable to provide a solution for them.
McHood and others say the depth of this recession has muddied the meaning of a low FICO score. The score is meant to size you up as a credit risk. To be sure, there are many people whose overspending, poor planning, and late bill payment have landed them under 600. A single delinquent bill can knock 100 points off your score. But waves of layoffs and the collapsed housing market have stung many who never exercised risky financial behavior. Stan Humphries is chief economist for the real estate site Zillow.com.
Not all of those people necessarily are bad credit risk. Some of them have not overextended themselves, but rather are in that situation because of larger economic issues of having to do with the recession.
But if your number's bad, lenders and landlords who often look at FICO scores before renting don't usually care why. Professional help is available, often for free. Gail Cunningham with the National Foundation for Credit Counseling says counseling can help people space out their debt payments.
100% of your debt will be repaid to your creditors, and it will be repaid within 5 years if you elect to go on a debt management plan.
There are also credit repair companies who, for a good-sized fee, will take a more aggressive approach. Since the recession, credit repair scams have exploded. A mortgage banker can refer you to one that's legit. And you can contact your creditors on your own to try to settle your unpaid debts. But be prepared. The act of settling is itself an unsightly ding on, you guessed it, your credit score. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace Money.
It's official. It is final. Almost 2 years after the near collapse of the financial system, the Senate voted 60-39 in favor of a reform bill that President Obama is expected to sign next week.
Reform that will protect consumers when they take out a mortgage or sign up for a credit card. Reform that will prevent the kind of shadowy deals that led to this crisis. Reform that would never again put taxpayers on the hook for Wall Street's mistakes. The reform that Congress passed today will accomplish these goals.
And yet there are holes. And to remind us what those are, we turned to Travis Plunkett, legislative director for the Consumer Federation of America. He said there are three big issues to watch out for.
The first is that automobile dealers are exempted from the authority of this agency when they loan money. 80% of all car loans are issued through auto dealers or by auto dealers.
And what's the caution there?
If we've learned anything from this economic crisis, it's that you need to oversee people based on what they do, not on who they are or who they say they are. And the problem here is that this agency will not have authority over dealers who loan money, but it will have authority over other people who loan money to buy cars. That could result in different kinds of regulation, in regulatory gaps, in weaknesses that could ultimately mean that consumers who buy autos and get auto loans from dealers are, you know, treated less fairly. I should mention on the auto dealers, there's one other piece to the story. What Congress has done is given new special authority to the Federal Trade Commission to go after lending abuses by auto dealers. And it may be that in a few years, the auto lenders are going to rue the day that they ever tried to get a special exception from this new consumer regulator's authority, because the Federal Trade Commission is now empowered with expedited rulemaking authority to examine auto dealer lending abuses. And Congress is now up to speed on what many of those abuses are. There's been a real education process. It's very likely the Federal Trade Commission is going to take new action against auto dealers who use abusive lending tactics.
Okay. So auto dealers, number one to watch. Number two?
There's a provision in the bill that allows small businesses to get an advanced look at any regulation put out by this new consumer regulator. This is an advanced look. And we're talking small businesses here. You know, predatory lenders can be small. We're concerned that this provision is going to give a sneak peek on new protections that the agency will offer to predatory small lenders. We have no problem if the agency pays special attention to small businesses and how they're affected by this regulation. We just don't think that small businesses, particularly small lenders, should get an advance look before the public ever sees what the agency's thinking about.
Okay, number three?
Small banks. The way that this law is written, the answer is that the bank regulators, who have traditionally overseen small banks, will do the enforcement. So the question is, what if they don't do their job? And there's nothing the consumer regulator can do about it. There's not even backup authority to go in and examine the small bank's books or issue an enforcement action if that small bank doesn't comply with consumer regulator rules. We're a little concerned about this because although small banks have been better behaved than big banks in the current crisis, that hasn't always been so. And sometimes small banks do offer abusive products or unfair tactics when dealing with consumers.
One of the criticisms of the bill is that so much is left to regulators to figure all this out, that it's not in the law how some of these behaviors will be dealt with. Are you concerned about that at all, given that regulators can change from administration to administration?
That's always a concern. But we're very encouraged. There really isn't a lot of discretion. The director will report only to the president. The funding for the agency, it will be hard to tamper with it. It will be hard for special interests to try and manipulate it or to lower it. This is going to be an agency that has the potential to really protect consumers.
Travis Plunkett is with the Consumer Federation of America, and we've been talking about the new Consumer Financial Protection Agency and the financial reform law that will be signed by the president next week. Thanks so much for coming in.
Certainly. Nice to talk to you, Tess.
One common piece of advice you'll hear for cutting the household budget is to take public transit. Get out of your car and onto the bus or the subway. But in some areas, that financial rule just doesn't cut it anymore because transit authorities are reducing service and raising fares. From WNYC, Matthew Sherman looks at how riders in New Jersey are coping with the new math.
Attention, Secaucus Junction customers.
The train station in Secaucus sits just across the Hudson River from Manhattan. Thousands of suburban commuters pass every day through the sleek and modern station. Marlene Micholi used to be one of those commuters, and she enjoyed riding the train.
I can read books, play crossword puzzles.
But Micholi now drives to work. Why? This spring, New Jersey Transit announced it would hike fares by as much as 25%. Micholi's a pharmaceutical consultant and couldn't help but run the numbers. She made an Excel spreadsheet to see if driving would be cheaper.
It really is pretty simple. I looked at the New Jersey Turnpike tolls.
Micholi found out she'd save $34 a month by taking her car instead of the train.
I think 25% increase is just, it's just so unrealistic.
New Jersey is just a part of a growing trend. The American Public Transportation Association says that more than half of large transit agencies across the country have increased fares over the last 2 years.
The train loses. Or I lose, I guess you can say, because I get to drive now. an hour and a half each way.
Once Mascioli started driving to work, she reported she actually liked it. Then again, Mascioli does a reverse commute, and driving simply isn't an option for most New Jersey Transit customers. They commute into crowded, expensive Manhattan every day, which is why the agency says more than 97% of its riders continue to take mass transit. People like Andy Cohen. He and his family moved to Madison, New Jersey, 2 years ago.
The train runs right along this ridge.
Madison is an old-fashioned small town about 20 miles west of Manhattan. Cohen teaches film and video at a Quaker school in Brooklyn, and his commute takes an hour and 20 minutes each way. Cohen says he's thought about driving.
I have a colleague that lives nearby, and we could commute. We could carpool, and it would be cheaper for us.
But they figured just one car accident and those calculations would get thrown off anyway.
The stress of driving back and forth to New York City every day would do me in.
The fare hike by New Jersey Transit means Cohen now has to pay $620 more a year to get to and from work.
We'll be eating out less frequently than we are already eating out less frequently.
With an annual household income a little over $100,000 and a daughter in college, Cohen's taking a close look at his budget.
I'm not going away this summer. I just need to save some money.
Because next fall, he'll be back on the train, a little less money in his wallet.
New York Penn Station, next to final stop.
In New York, I'm Matthew Sherman for Marketplace Money.
And it's time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is Kathy Kristoff with us from CBS Money Watch. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much, Tess. It's always fun.
You know, it's been a few weeks since we've had you on the program. And in the meantime, it looks like we will actually have a financial reform bill. And I'm wondering, just kind of as you look through it, give us some of your thoughts on good, bad, indifferent. Does it do what you were hoping it would?
You know, one of the problems with answering that question is so much of it still waits on regulation. So
right.
Even after it's passed, I think it's going to be some time before we really know what's going to happen. Are consumers going to be protected? Are they going to be overprotected? I'm almost a little bit worried about Big Mother, you know. And our federal government is passing a lot of restrictions. And while on one hand that's good, because I think we went way too far the other way and not having any restrictions at all and
right.
people, you know, getting caught in toxic products. But when you go too far, I think people's guard gets let down. And then you become a ready victim for a scam artist who knows that you don't have your antenna up. You still need to be on your guard. You know, you
right.
need to read the fine print, unfortunately. And there's so much of it.
There is. There certainly is. But you know where we have no fine print?
Where?
With our calls. So shall we take some caller questions?
I'd love that.
All right. Well, first we have Aubrey on the line from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi, Aubrey.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Excellent, excellent. What do you do there in Oklahoma City?
I am a catering director for a pretty great little independent taco shack.
How cool.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah, so I am in charge of booking and facilitating and setting up all of our catered parties and events and lunches and dinners and that sort of thing.
Are you thinking about perhaps doing what is the real trend out here, which is a truck?
We actually have two trucks.
You have two trucks? All right.
Yeah, we have two trucks that are, right now, they're both out selling lunch, but we do them for private parties as well. And so that's another big part of my job is scheduling the trucks and making sure that they get where they need to be and where they're going to make the most money.
All right. So Oklahoma City was ahead of L.A. in this trend, I guess, Kathy.
It sounds
no,
like
we,
it.
We kind of piggybacked. Actually, we bought our first truck in L.A. So we flew out to L.A., bought the
really?
Truck, drove it back. Yep.
How
well,
fun.
I'm just wondering if you want to drive out here for lunch.
You guys have some pretty good truck, taco truck and different other food truck options out there. I don't think you need us.
Ooh, it is. It's like an entire culture here.
I'm jealous of your waffle truck that you have.
Oh, waffle the waffle truck? Yeah, I've heard of the waffle truck and the grilled cheese truck.
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh, yeah.
Great.
Okay, these I missed.
So is this a question about your small business then?
It's not, actually. actually. This is a personal question. I have recently gotten engaged.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. And one of the first questions that came up when my fiancé and I started talking about merging our lives in the near future was financially related. We were kind of actually hoping that maybe you could point us in the direction of any sort of financial counseling service that specializes in counseling couples how to smartly merge their finances. And in lieu of that, because we can't seem to find anything of that, maybe just answer a couple of the questions that we have that we're not really sure how to approach.
Well, I guess, Kathy, perhaps the first question to ask Aubrey is, how much have you talked about your finances together? Have you sat down and gone over your bills and your savings and your debt?
Not really in depth. We both have sort of a vague idea of where the other is. My fiancé also, I should say, is in med school right now. I know that he's, you know, living on student loans at the moment and will be for the next few years.
Wow.
And he knows that I have some student loans, but we haven't looked at hard figures. We've just kind of talked about it in the abstract.
Well, those are good things to do. Some of the things you need to do is actually just sit down, you know, like make it a date and say, you know, let's both get our credit reports. And
that sounds like a really great date.
Yeah, I may be the dullest woman in America. but you know what? You can get them online. They're free. And that credit report is going to tell you how much debt you each have outstanding and
right.
give you an idea of how you guys spend. I think one of the biggest things that can tear a marriage apart is having very different approaches to money. You know, one
right.
person's a saver, one person's a spender. What you really need to do is make sure you're kind of on the same page. You have similar goals and you have a similar approach to money.
Excellent. And then the other sort of larger question is, because he's a full-time student and with med school just not able to even have a part-time job, the big question that kind of is scaring us both, I guess, is that I have obviously some disposable income or some expendable money coming in every month that doesn't go toward bills. How much of that should I really put toward his half of the living expenses so that we can cut down on the student loans without not being able to ever go out to dinner or go buy a new pair of shoes or anything like that? I mean, is it realistic?
Well, you know what I would encourage you to do? There's a website called finaid.org. And on there, there's a student loan section. It has a little calculator so that you can play with the numbers and see how much your payments are going to be when your fiance gets out of school, you know, based on roughly how much debt he's going to have, right?
Right.
And that can help you make that decision.
Okay.
But Kathy, what about, you know, I think there's also a larger question here that Aubrey is asking, which is, you know, when you are entering into a relationship, particularly a permanent one like a marriage or a partnership, how do you kind of decide who's going to pay for what and who's responsible for what? You know, this gets into even brass tacks, like, you know, do you share a checking account or do you have separate accounts? Aubrey, is that kind of where you're going as well?
Yeah, I mean, all of those things are, you know, things that we're going to have to tackle before we get married next year.
Yeah, and when you have one half of the partnership who has an income and the other who doesn't going into the marriage,
right.
You know, that's
well, you know,
sticky wicket.
You know what? It's a sticky wicket all the time. I really think that these are things that make a lot of sense to discuss because money has got a lot of implications that aren't just about what you can buy. And so you need to know where your spouse is on all of those issues before you actually get married. It's definitely something to chat about a lot.
Kathy, why is this topic so difficult for us to talk about? I mean, there are surveys that show that people will talk about sex more than they will talk about money, even in their relationships.
I know. You know, I don't really get it. Maybe it's because sometimes talking about money seems petty, but really, these are about big picture things. These are about, you know, how much can I trust you? What do we see as our big goals and dreams in life? That's really what the money discussion is about.
Yeah. So does that help you out, Aubrey?
It does. It gives me a lot of, I think, some guidelines really to approach this instead of it just being like, oh gosh, what do we do? Now we have some concrete things of, okay, let's get out
right.
the paperwork, let's sit down, let's look at it. We'll hopefully get off on the right foot.
All right. Well, good luck with the planning.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye. All right, we've got Emily on the phone, and she is in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
And any wedding planning in the offing for you?
No, we're already done with that.
Done with that. How long have you been married?
We've been married 12 years now.
12 years. Fantastic. Any kids in the picture?
Yeah, we have 5 boys, including 2 sets of twins.
Wow. 2 sets of twins.
I know.
You're wild. Busy.
Yeah, it is. It's very busy.
So let me take a guess. Does this have anything to do with saving money for college?
Well, actually, it doesn't. I've skipped a step, and I have a retirement savings question.
Oh, fantastic. Good for you. All right. Well, hit us.
Well, we're low-income family. My husband is a self-employed contractor, and it's kind of a difficult climate for that right now.
Yeah, I bet.
And I'm just kind of worried, given that we are sort of check-to-check living right now, how is it that we are to save for retirement? And to throw a wrench in it, we're a Muslim family, and so we don't deal in interest.
Oh, right. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned that you're a Muslim household, and so you don't deal in interest. And this is a part of Sharia law. You want to share with us what that is?
Well, Muslims tend to view dealing in interest as sort of the wealthy profiting from, like, those who are in financially weaker positions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess considered a little immoral, so we try to avoid it as best we can.
And what does that mean? It means, for example, that you can't have a traditional savings account?
Yeah.
What kind of annual income do you have?
Well, I hate to admit it. We're around $40,000 a year.
Well, $40,000 with 5 children.
Yeah,
we're
trying to figure it out.
Wow.
Yeah. I know, it's bleak, but yeah, and given that my husband does do manual labor and works so hard, I really don't want him to be doing this sort of thing in his late 60s. And I have one of my kids is a special needs child, and it's hard for me to get a job out of the home right now.
You've got a lot of challenges, economic challenges.
Yeah, a lot of challenges.
Let me throw a couple things at you. One of the things you should know is there is something called individual development accounts. And these are match savings accounts that are offered by different groups. United Way sponsors a group of them. Every state has different ones. And what they do is they match an education program with a savings account. And so you could save as little as $20 a month. And when you're done and you meet some goal, they'll actually match your savings, sometimes 1-to-1, sometimes it's 3-to-1. But your savings has to be for specific goals that, you know, meet their criteria.
Wow.
That also sounds like it very much fits in with the Sharia law restrictions. This is not interest. It's a matching program.
Exactly. Now, are you also getting the low-income tax credit?
Yes, we are.
Okay, good. So that should help.
So Emily, let me ask you. I mean, we're talking about even $10 a month. Is that even feasible for you?
That is feasible.
It is, yeah. I mean, it's a start, Kathy, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, I just wrote about these individual development accounts, and I was talking to a gal who has a child. She's a single mom, and she was earning $14,000. And somehow or another, she managed to save as well. One of the benefits to going to these programs is that they're familiar with all of the other social programs that can help you.
Okay.
And so they may also be able to help you get a little bit of respite care for your son, and maybe help you figure out a way to earn a little income on the side.
Yeah.
All right. Does that help you out, Emily?
It does a lot. Thank you.
All right. Well, good luck to you. And thanks so much for the call.
Yeah. Thank
you. Thanks. Bye.
All right, well, let's go to our next caller. Greg is on the line from Boise, Idaho. Hi, Greg.
Hi, this is Greg with Solar Concepts.
Solar Concepts. Okay, ooh. Well, you got a plug-in for your company. And what do you do with Solar Concepts?
Well, I'm certified with Solar Electric, and basically we install tubular skylights. We work with people for solar electric options on their houses.
So you're an electrician?
I am not a registered journeyman electrician. You could say I'm a solar electrician, but that is a different voltage range that you work on, and you don't generally do the final connect to the grid.
So there are different voltage...
Exactly. It has a lot to do with the safety level of the voltage in concern.
So you're low voltage and you don't have high voltage.
Right. If you do low voltage, you don't do high voltage. What you should think about is think of water in a pipe. and compare it to a garden hose and a fire hose. You could have a garden hose on super high pressure and it wouldn't hurt you very much. Or you could have a fire hose on fairly low pressure and it'd still knock you over.
Gotcha. You ever been shocked?
I was shocked with high voltage once when I was in the military. It's not fun.
Well, tell us what you're looking for, Greg. What's going on in your life that you want to get a little advice on?
Well, my wife and I were trying to refinance our house.
So have you started looking at rates and talking to banks?
We actually started in September of last year.
Wow.
And you guys have done a couple of stories on the HARP loan program.
Right. This is the Home Affordable Refinance Program through the government.
Exactly. And initially, we tried to do it through our originating bank.
Mm-hmm.
Got everything from, that program doesn't exist, to you're not eligible for it. Basically, every time we called, we got a different response.
Greg, can you fill me in on why you're going through a government program rather than a traditional refinance?
Well, we bought our house originally at the peak of the bubble. So we have a pretty significant loan-to-value difference. We've been able to make all of our payments. So my wife and I just simply want a refinance.
What's your interest rate at now?
6.75 is, I think, what we started at. Just recently, I think it's down in around 4.65 has been a number that we have been offered, or 4.75. So it's completely in our favor to try and get this refinanced.
Yeah, it certainly is.
So now what's the problem? You can't get anybody to do the loan?
Basically, we have had, it was like pulling teeth to get Citibank to do our loan. And literally, it's been a battle since September of last year. They are kind of offering a HARP loan, but it's at 5.8% interest and at huge closing costs. Since I was in the military in the past, I'm eligible for a VA loan, which looks like it'll be in the 4.75 range. So my question for you guys was, is it worth me continuing to pursue a HARP loan option, or would it be better for me to pursue the VA?
I would say VA. Yeah. I mean, first of all, the HARP option is really intended for people who are in a serious bind with their finances and their mortgages. If you're just looking for a direct refinance, that's not a program that you're going to need to go through. You know, have you talked to the VA about your options with them?
I have, and that loan is moving forward a little bit better.
To me, there's not even a question here. The VA loan sounds like it's a much better deal. You know, at some point after you beat your head against a wall for a certain amount of time, you got to imagine that it hurts, right?
Right.
And it's time to stop. Why would you even hesitate? Is there some reason that you're not sure that the VA loan is a better idea?
Well, and that's kind of why my question was, are there any downsides to the VA loan? Back when I was, 25 and first looking at the VA loan, a standard 30-year ended up having less strings attached.
Well, that can be the case. I mean, some government loan programs do have mortgage insurance and different things like
right.
that, which, you know, can increase the cost of the loan. But given what your options appear to be, then I think that's what mortgage insurance is for. And that's not really a downside. So I'd go with the VA.
All right. So does that help you out, Greg?
It does. And it was a pleasure. I'm glad you guys were able to answer my questions. And I think I'll go with the VA.
All right. Sounds like a plan.
Terrific.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. You guys have a good day.
Well, unfortunately, Kathy, that is all the time we've got for this week. If you folks have a question for us, do give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can always email your question at the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Kathy Kristoff of CBS Money Watch, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tess.
And remember to check with your financial expert before making any big money decisions. If you have health insurance, and we sure hope you do, chances are you've spent some time on the phone trying to make sense of your paperwork. what's approved, what's denied, which part is an actual bill. Well, our sister program Marketplace recently featured a story about a call center in Kentucky where the Convergys Corporation trains insurance industry phone reps in how to express empathy. Our listener inbox overflowed. A typical comment went something like this: empathy, my fill in the blank. We asked reporter Gregory Warner to lead us through how a health insurance call center rep is created.
If you show up at this call center in Erlinger, Kentucky, trying to get a job answering the phones for a large health plan, first you'll take a typing test and then a math quiz. Then you'll sit down at a computer to take an empathy exam.
If the individual is lacking in that area, empathy is a very hard thing to train.
That's Vice President Christine Kowalczyk. She oversees the whole empathy push here at the Convergys Corporation, and she's agreed to take the multiple choice test. This question begins with a simulation of a frustrated caller.
You've been transferred to three different departments and been put on hold for a total of 30 minutes. Your customer service is horrible. All I want to do is pay my bill.
Now, you have to choose the correct empathetic response. Is it A?
I'm sorry you had difficulty reaching the customer service department. Our phone connection can be unreliable.
Okay, that sounds pretty understanding.
I can tell you right now that's probably not the right answer.
Okay, maybe not so much.
Why? Because what you're doing is validating the negativity of the caller.
In other words, telling the caller that the company messed up. Next.
B, I'm sorry you had difficulty reaching the customer service department. I will speak to my supervisor about reducing your bill because of the hardships you've had.
Well, this seems pretty empathetic, B.
It is absolutely empathetic, but it's probably not yet appropriate.
You got to sweat a lot more than that to get your bill reduced.
C, I'm sorry you had difficulty reaching the customer service department. It can be confusing, but I will make a recommendation to my supervisor about simplifying the process.
Okay, I'm guessing that Christine's going to say this answer is wrong, too, because the art of empathy as it's practiced here in the call center is acknowledge the concern without validating it. Diffuse the caller without actually committing yourself to any course of action, as in...
D, I'm sorry you had difficulty reaching the customer service department. My name is David, and I will help you pay your bill.
I want to make a notation that I actually spoke with you today.
There's a reason that this is always the answer we end up with. Companies like Convergys get hired by your insurance company to handle its customer service calls. But Convergys' goal is to get rid of you as quickly as possible. Agents have a target to finish a call in 3 minutes and 30 seconds. It's like speed dating, 125 times a day, with people who are scared, anxious, frustrated, and confused.
I care. I understand.
I understand your frustration regarding this issue.
I must apologize for any information, or... I'll say, I'll be glad to help you with that.
I apologize that you've had to go through this many times.
I understand. Let me help you.
All that empathy language is the sound of the call agent trying to manage our emotions and keep that call flowing. Agents get penalized by their supervisors if they let the call get away from them.
When the call gets away from me, that definition to me is when the person calling in takes control. They're leading the call.
Call agent Danielle Witt answers each call with something pretty standard.
Thank you for calling customer service. My name is Danielle. How may I help you?
Then she waits for your next move. If you ask about your benefits, she'll offer a list of providers. If you ask about providers, she'll send you a Google map. Because the company's learned that the most efficient call is one where the customer says nothing, except for yes, no, and here's my PIN number. And though we feel like we're the ones in charge when we call, Danielle says, actually, we want to be led.
It tends to be that the customer doesn't like to take control, would rather not.
And so the Convergys Corporation spends a lot of time analyzing the 1 billion calls they get every year. They want to determine what words neutralize us and make us surrender. Agents are trained to have a confident tone of voice, so we don't doubt what they're saying and hang up and call back.
I mean, it's a science and art that is just amazing.
Christine Kowalczyk, the vice president, can watch you struggle through an automated phone maze.
You don't know how many consumers will immediately try to find what's the one number that's going to get me out of this box and into a live agent.
Right.
Absolutely. Do you do it? You're laughing because you do it, aren't you?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Christine says that the automated phone system is cheaper than letting you talk to a human being. So if a company pays Convergys enough to staff a lot of call agents...
If you push zero, you get to an agent.
But if that company stints on its customer service...
You push every single number, you're never going anywhere.
The challenge for any company is to juggle their customer service and their bottom line. But for health plans, this is even more of a question because customers need so much time and so much help on the phone. One of the call center supervisors even told me,
I believe that your health benefits are something that no one will ever understand. I will never understand mine either.
So Convergys is now trying to sell insurance companies on a new approach. Call it the behavioral approach. Companies will analyze so much data about customers and customer patterns, they'll be able to tell you why you're calling even before you say hello.
I see you are calling about a recent medical claim processed on October 30th.
In that not-so-distant future, the most empathetic voice you hear might just be a robot's. In Erlanger, Kentucky, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace Money.
I'll tell you who could use a little empathy training. Debt collectors. Yeah, maybe they could send robots on that one, too. This week, the Federal Trade Commission issued a report calling for major changes in the debt collection industry, especially the way it uses the court system to squeeze people for payment. The report called on states to make it easier for consumers to defend themselves, and it said consumers should be given a clear choice between agreeing to arbitration or going to court. Robert Andrews analyzes the debt industry for IBIS World, and he says it's no surprise that the issue is front and center in the middle of a recession.
Debt collectors have had to become a little bit more aggressive to collect payment on delinquent debt just due to the fact that unemployment has increased. Consumers are struggling to just make payments.
The FTC has also found that debt collectors are getting more aggressive, leading to an increase in consumer complaints of harassment.
Contacting individuals before 8 a.m. or after 9 p.m. at night, communicating with consumers at their workplace, reporting false information on a consumer's credit report. Debt collectors have used profanity, even threats of bodily harm.
Consumers do have some protections already. They can sue debt collectors if they can prove harassment.
Additionally, due to some recent cases associated with large civil penalties, I also see that as a deterrent for future aggressive tactics. And on top of that, the FTC is actually reviewing its current policies and actually looking to make some changes to increase punishment.
So in the end, debt collectors could end up owing someone money and ultimately find themselves in need of a little empathy. Spain has been on a collection binge lately, collecting sports trophies. A Spaniard won Wimbledon, and the Spanish team won the World Cup. But it has also been collecting a whole lot of national debt, leading to quite the fractured economy. And kids are paying a big share of the price. Spain now holds the worst record in Europe for youth employment. From Madrid, our European Bureau Chief Stephen Beard reports.
Spain celebrates victory this week in the Soccer World Cup. Young men on the national team have made the nation proud. Meanwhile, many other young Spaniards are suffering the misery of Spain's biggest failure.
I finished the university 2 years ago. I haven't found a job. I'm graduate. I have a master. I can speak English and French. And I can find a job. I can't.
Millions of young Spaniards like her are unemployed. 40% of 16 to 24-year-olds, 40% are out of work. Many of them, like Esther del Castillo Alvarez, are well-educated.
My situation is the same as many people of my age who have done degrees. They have spent time working abroad trying to get extra experience in languages, and we can't find work. It's upsetting. It's terrible.
Esther, who has a degree in communications, has been looking for a job for 2 years. She's now on a government scheme, receiving a grant of around $1,200 a month, not enough for an independent existence in Madrid, and the grant ends in 6 months.
I live with my parents. When my grants run out, I don't know what will happen. Do I feel betrayed? Yes, totally. I'm 28 years old and completely disillusioned.
Esther is a casualty of Spain's dual labor market, the stark divide between permanent and temporary employees. two-thirds of Spanish workers are classed as permanent. It's very expensive to fire them. They can get up to 4 years' pay. So employers hang on to them even in the deepest downturn. New job seekers don't get a look in, and the one-third on temporary contracts are highly vulnerable. Monica de Carvalho worked as a nurse here in Spain for 8 years on a series of short-term contracts, some lasting less than a month.
You never know when you are going to be working, when you are going to stop working, and you can't plan long-term. You can't buy a flat, you can't buy things, because you don't know when you are going to finish.
Monica is on a visit to Madrid. She now lives and works as a nurse in Britain.
Do you think you'll ever come back and live in Spain?
I don't think so. I think I will work there and I will come here to visit the country, because the situation, working situation, at the day of today is easier there. It's more hope there.
In Britain?
Yeah, I think so.
Under pressure from its European partners, Spain has begun loosening its rigid labour code. It's passed a law making it cheaper to fire permanent workers. Easier to fire, easier to hire. That's the thinking. But even some of the victims of the current system, like Esther del Castillo Alvarez, don't entirely buy the new approach.
I don't know whether making it cheaper to fire people really makes the situation any better. Because I ask myself, if so many people are being fired and losing their jobs, wouldn't making it easier to fire people make the situation even worse?
Many ask the same question. Gail Allard, professor of economics at the IE Business School in Madrid, says there's not a huge appetite for reform.
The people on the outside just want to get inside. So they really don't want to dismantle the system. They also want to be paid 4 years of salary if they're dismissed. So there's tremendous resistance to change.
Labour unions mounted this protest against the labour reform. They're planning an even bigger action in September, a general strike. Spain seems set to keep its unenviable record for the worst youth unemployment in the Western world. In Madrid, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And now a quick update on a story we aired a couple of months ago about something called haul videos, where people show off all their purchases on YouTube.
Hey guys, okay, I just got home from a long day of shopping at the mall, and I just wanted to show you what I got at the mall today. This one is $580, and it's just a simple gold belt right here.
Turns out we weren't the only ones paying attention. This week, JCPenney announced it's planning to give gift cards to teens who buy stuff at the store and make videos about their haul. Penney says the video stars will explain that the company compensated them for their views, and that could do some damage to what little credibility the hauls did have. Jessica Cohen is editor-in-chief of Jezebel.com, an online site that tracks consumer trends for women.
In one way, it's really positive that girls can become trusted authorities amongst one another. But when you bring money into it and when you are pushing a product, then your authenticity is at risk.
And as more stores make like JCPenney, the FTC is going to get involved. Haulers will have to disclose any money they get from retailers, because then it's called advertising. And another update, this time from last week's show. We invited all you cheapskates out there to tell us your tales of frugality, but with a twist. We wanted to hear how trying to save a buck ended up costing you more. You sent, shall we say, some interesting confessions. A free quart of paint led to a $2,000 bathroom remodel. Cheap diapers equaled damaged clothes on baby and parent. And a $75 donkey purchase, I'm sorry, guard donkey purchase, resulted in a $400 vet bill. Vet visits were something of a theme, actually. Here's a sampling of the rest.
My name is Carrie Brief. I live in Raleigh, North Carolina. My wife and I bought a house built in 1835 that needed a lot of work. We needed wood to redo the house, and instead of buying new lumber, I decided to look for a free barn, dismantle it, and use it to rebuild our dream home. I bought a sawmill at $18,000, a trailer for $350, at least $1,200 worth of hand and power tools and safety equipment, a $6,500 tree lift truck to get up high, which died about 10 miles from where I bought it and cost thousands to have it fixed and towed. Then I hired a tow truck to pull the barn down for $600 and then $1,500 to have a guy haul all the material to my backyard. Then the neighbors got mad. It only took 8 years to get the work done, and I didn't end up using the wood on the house anyway. Lots of fun, but too much stress and a big financial loss. Really big.
My name is Nick Brown. I live in Redondo Beach, California. During the heady dot-com boom, I tried a website called cyberrebates.com after a few friends had tried it successfully. The idea was that you bought an item at a very high price, but then you'd get a rebate for 100% of the purchase price. Thus, while you overpaid, it was to be temporary, and in the end, you got the item for free. I bought a CD player for $500 when the retail price at a local electronics store was just $120. Everything was fine until cyberrebates.com went bankrupt and was unable to fulfill its rebate. In the end, I ended up paying four or five times what the CD player was worth.
My name is James Wagner. I'm a transportation planner in Tulsa, Oklahoma. After a long, hot, tiring trip to Washington, D.C. for Independence Day in 2007, my wife and I flew back home. Our flight was delayed due to weather, and we ended up back at the airport at 1:30 in the morning. Rather than taking a cab home, I insisted that we wait until the public transit train started running at 5 a.m. so we could get home for $3 rather than $45. We slept in the airport until 5 a.m. and then took a train to a bus to get home, and we're still married.
All right, we promised a limited edition Marketplace Money piggy bank to the best or worst story. And our winner is the free barn wood that cost North Carolina's Kerry Brief more than $28,000, and he didn't even use it. There is more at marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, mortgages are incredibly cheap these days, but that doesn't mean it's any easier to buy a home.
Interest rates definitely are a key factor for people being motivated to buy. What's coupled with that, though, it's very difficult to get a loan under normal circumstances, especially as compared to 2 or 3 years ago when all you had to do was be breathing to get a loan.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman, Angela Kim, and Nihar Patel. And a warm hello to our new listeners on WABE in Atlanta, Georgia. Please send Peach Cobbler. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering strategies for investors seeking both returns and lower volatility. On the web at putnam.com/absolute return.
American Public Media.